goodness, was not a physical property and was not measurable. He had been thrown off by an ambiguity in the term quality. He wondered why that ambiguity should exist, made a mental note to do some digging into the historic roots of the word quality, then put it aside. The horn of the dilemma was still there. He turned his attention to the other horn of the dilemma, which showed more promise of refutation. He thought, "So quality is whatever you like." It angered him. The great artists of history, Raphael, Beethoven, Michelangelo, they were all just putting out what people liked. They had no goal other than to titillate the senses in a big way. Was that it? It was angering, and what was most angering about it was that he couldn't see any immediate way to cut it up logically. So he studied the statement carefully, in the same reflective way he always studied things before attacking them. Then he saw it. He brought out the knife and excised the one word that created the entire angering effect of that sentence. The word just. Why should quality be just what you like? Why should what you like be just? What did just mean in this case? When separated out like this for independent examination, it became apparent that just in this case really didn't mean a damn thing. It was a purely pejorative term whose logical contribution to the sentence was nil. Now, with that word removed, the sentence became, "Quality is what you like," and its meaning was entirely changed. It had become an innocuous truism. He wondered why that statement had angered him so much in the first place. It had seemed so natural. Why had it taken so long to see that what it really said was, "What you like is bad, or at least inconsequential"? What was behind this smug presumption that what pleased you was bad, or at least unimportant in comparison to other things? It seemed the quintessence of the squareness he was fighting. Little children were trained not to do just what they liked, but what? Of course, what others liked. And which others? Parents, teachers, supervisors, policemen, judges, officials, kings, dictators. All authorities. When you are trained to despise just what you like, then, of course you become a much more obedient servant of others, a good slave. When you learn not to do just what you like, then the system loves you. But suppose you do just what you like. Does that mean you're going to go about and shoot heroin, rob banks, and rape old ladies? The person who is counseling you not to do just as you like is making some remarkable presumptions as to what is likable. He seems unaware that people may not rob banks because they have considered the consequences and decided they don't like to. He doesn't see that banks exist in the first place because they're just what people like, namely, providers of loans. Petrus began to wonder how all this condemnation of what you like ever seemed such a natural objection in the first place. Soon he saw there was much more to this than he had been aware of. When people said, "Don't do just what you like," they didn't mean obey authority. They also meant something else. This something else opened up into a huge area of classic scientific belief which stated that what you like is unimportant because it's all composed of irrational emotions within yourself. He studied this argument for a long time, then knifed it into two smaller groups, which he called scientific materialism and classic formalism. He said the two are often found associated in the same person, but logically are separate. Scientific materialism, which is commoner among lay followers of science than among scientists themselves, holds that what is composed of matter or energy and is measurable by the instruments of science is real. Anything else is unreal, or at least of no importance. What you like is unmeasurable and therefore unreal. What you like can be a fact or it can be an hallucination. Liking does not distinguish between the two. The whole purpose of scientific method is to make valid distinctions between the false and the true in nature, to eliminate the subjective, unreal, imaginary elements from one's work so as to obtain an objective, true picture of reality. When he said quality was subjective, to them he was just saying quality is imaginary, and could therefore be disregarded in any serious consideration of reality. On the other hand, is classical formalism, which insists that what isn't understood intellectually isn't understood at all. Quality in this case is unimportant because it's an emotional understanding unaccompanied by the intellectual elements of reason. Of these two main sources of that epithet, just, Phaedrus felt that the first, scientific materialism, was by far the easiest to cut to ribbons. This, he knew from his earlier education, was naive science. He went after it first, using the reductio ad absurdum. This form of argument rests on the truth that if the inevitable conclusions from a set of premises are absurd, then it follows logically that at least one of the premises that produce them is absurd. Let's examine, he said, what follows from the premises that anything not composed of mass energy is unreal or unimportant. He used the number zero as a starter. Zero, originally a Hindu number, was introduced to the West by the Arabs during the Middle Ages and was unknown to the ancient Greeks and Romans. How was that? He wondered. Had nature so subtly hidden zero that all the Greeks and all the Romans, millions of them, couldn't find it? One would normally think that zero is right out there in the open for everyone to see. He showed the absurdity of trying to derive zero from any form of mass energy, and then asked, rhetorically, if that meant the number zero was unscientific. If so, did that mean that digital computers, which function exclusively in terms of ones and zeros, should be limited to just ones for scientific works? No trouble finding the absurdity here. He then went on with other scientific concepts, one by one, showing how they could not possibly exist independently of subjective considerations. He ended up with the law of gravity in the example I gave John and Sylvia and Chris on the first night of our trip. If subjectivity is eliminated as unimportant, he said, then the entire body of science must be eliminated with it. This refutation of scientific materialism, however, seemed to put him in the camp of philosophic idealism. Berkeley, Hume, Kant, Fichte, Schelling, Hegel, Bradley, Bosanquet. Good company, all. Logical to the last comma, but so difficult to justify in common-sense language, they seemed a burden to him in his defense of quality, rather than an aid. The argument that the world was all mind might be a sound logical position, but it was certainly not a sound rhetorical one. It was way too tedious and difficult for a course in freshman composition. Too far-fetched. At this point, the whole subjective horn of the dilemma looked almost as uninspiring as the objective one. And the arguments of classical formalism, when he started to examine them, made it even worse. These were the extremely forceful arguments that you shouldn't respond to your immediate emotional impulses without considering the big rational picture. Kids are told, "Don't spend your whole allowance for bubblegum." Immediate emotional impulse. Because you're going to want to spend it for something else later. Big picture. Adults are told, "This paper mill may smell awful, even with the best controls," immediate emotions, "but without it, the economy of the whole town will collapse." Big picture. In terms of our old dichotomy, what's being said is don't base your decisions on romantic surface appeal without considering classical underlying form. This was something he kind of agreed with. What the classical formalists meant by the objection, "quality is just what you like," was that this subjective undefined quality he was teaching was just romantic surface appeal. Classroom popularity contests could determine whether a composition had immediate appeal, all right. But was this quality? Was quality something that you just see? Or might it be something more subtle than that, so that you wouldn't see it at all immediately, but only after a long period of time? The more he examined this argument, the more formidable it appeared. This looked like the one that might do in his whole thesis. What made it so ominous was that it seemed to answer a question that had arisen often in class, and which he always had to answer somewhat casuistically. This was the question, if everyone knows what quality is, why is there such a disagreement about it? His casuist answer had been that although pure quality was the same for everyone, the objects that people said quality inhered in varied from person to person. As long as he left quality undefined, there was no way to argue with this. But he knew, and he knew the students knew, that it had the smell of falseness about it. It didn't really answer the question. Now there was an alternative explanation. People disagreed about quality because some just used their immediate emotions, whereas others applied their overall knowledge. He knew that in any popularity contest among English teachers, this latter argument, which bolstered their authority, would win overwhelming endorsement. But this argument was completely devastating. Instead of one single uniform quality, now there appeared to be two qualities, a romantic one, just seeing, which the students had, and a classic one, overall understanding, which the teachers had. A hip one and a square one. Squareness was not the absence of quality, it was classic quality. Hipness was not just presence of quality, it was mere romantic quality. The hip-square cleavage he'd discovered was still there, but quality didn't now seem to fall entirely on one side of the cleavage, as he'd previously supposed. Instead, quality itself cleaved into two kinds, one on each side of the cleavage line. His simple, neat, beautiful, undefined quality was starting to get complex. He didn't like the way this was going. The cleavage term that was going to unify the classic and romantic ways of looking at things had itself been cleaved into two parts and could no longer unify anything. It had been caught in an analytic meat grinder. The knife of subjectivity and objectivity had cut quality in two and killed it as a working concept. If he was going to save it, he couldn't let that knife get it. And really, the quality he was talking about wasn't classic quality or romantic quality. It was beyond both of them. And by God, it wasn't subjective or objective either. It was beyond both of those categories. Actually, this whole dilemma of subjectivity-objectivity, of mind-matter, with relationship to quality, was unfair. That mind-matter relationship had been an intellectual hang-up for centuries. They were just putting that hang-up on top of quality to drag quality down. How could he say whether quality was mind or matter when there was no logical clarity as to what was mind and what was matter in the first place? And so, he rejected the left horn. Quality is not objective, he said. It doesn't reside in the material world. Then, he rejected the right horn. Quality is not subjective, he said. It doesn't reside merely in the mind. And finally, Phaedrus, following a path that to his knowledge had never been taken before in the history of Western thought, went straight between the horns of the subjectivity-objectivity dilemma and said quality is neither a part of mind, nor is it a part of matter. It is a third entity which is independent of the two. He was heard along the corridors and up and down the stairs of Montana Hall, singing softly to himself, almost under his breath, "Holy, holy, holy, blessed Trinity." And there is a faint, faint fragment of memory, possibly wrong, possibly just something I'm imagining, that says he just let the whole thought structure sit like that for weeks, without carrying it any further. Chris shouts, "When are we going to get to the top?" "Probably quite a way yet," I reply. "Will we see a lot?" "I think so. Look for blue sky between the trees. As long as we can't see sky, we know it's a way yet. The light will come through the trees when we round the top." Last night's rain has soaked this soft duft of needles sufficiently to make them good walking. Sometimes, when it's really dry on a slope like this, they become slippery, and you have to dig your feet into them edgewise, or you'll slide down. I say to Chris, "Isn't it great when there's no underbrush like this?" "Why isn't there any?" he asks. "I think this area must never have been logged. When a forest is left alone like this for centuries, the trees shut out all the underbrush."
"It's like a park," Chris says.
"You can sure see all around." His mood seems much better than yesterday. I think he'll be a good traveler from here on. This forest silence improves anyone. The world now, according to Phaedrus, was composed of three things: mind, matter, and quality. The fact that he had established no relationship between them didn't bother him at first. If the relationship between mind and matter had been fought over for centuries and wasn't yet resolved, why should he, in a matter of a few weeks, come up with something conclusive about quality? So he let it go. He put it up on a kind of mental shelf, where he put all kinds of questions he had no immediate answers for. He knew the metaphysical trinity of subject, object, and quality would sooner or later have to be interrelated, but he was in no hurry about it. It was just so satisfying to be beyond the danger of those horns that he relaxed and enjoyed it as long as he could. Eventually, however, he examined it more closely. Although there's no logical objection to a metaphysical trinity, a three-headed reality, such trinities are not common or popular. The metaphysician normally seeks either a monism, such as God, which explains the nature of the world as a manifestation of one single thing, or he seeks a dualism, such as mind-matter, which explains it as two things, or he leaves it as a pluralism, which explains it as a manifestation of an indefinite number of things. But three is an awkward number. Right away you want to know, why three? What's the relationship among them? And as the need for relaxation diminished, Phaedrus became curious about this relationship too. He noted that although normally you associate quality with objects, feelings of quality sometimes occur without any object at all. This is what led him at first to think that maybe quality is all subjective. But subjective pleasure wasn't what he meant by quality either. Quality decreases subjectivity. Quality takes you out of yourself, makes you aware of the world around you. Quality is opposed to subjectivity. I don't know how much thought passed before he arrived at this, but eventually he saw that quality couldn't be independently related with either the subject or the object, but could be found only in the relationship of the two with each other. It is the point at which subject and object meet. That sounded warm. Quality is not a thing, it is an event. Warmer. It is the event at which the subject becomes aware of the object. And because without objects there can be no subject, because the objects create the subject's awareness of himself, quality is the event at which awareness of both subjects and objects is made possible. Hot. Now he knew it was coming. This means quality is not just the result of a collision between subject and object. The very existence of subject and object themselves is deduced from the quality event. The quality event is the cause of the subjects and objects, which are then mistakenly presumed to be the cause of the quality. Now he had that whole damned evil dilemma by the throat. The dilemma all the time had this unseen, vile presumption in it, for which there was no logical justification, that quality was the effect of subjects and objects. It was not. He brought out his knife. The sun of quality, he wrote, does not revolve around the subjects and objects of our existence. It does not just passively illuminate them. It is not subordinate to them in any way. It has created them. They are subordinate to it. And at that point, when he wrote that, he knew he had reached some kind of culmination of thought he had been unconsciously striving for over a long period of time. "Blue sky!" shouts Chris. There it is, way above us. A narrow patch of blue through the trunks of the trees. We move faster, and the patches of blue become larger and larger through the trees, and soon we see that the trees thin out to a bare spot at the summit. When the summit is about 50 yards away, I say, "Let's go," and start to dash for it, throwing into the effort all the reserves of energy I've been saving. I give it everything I have, but Chris gains on me. Then he passes me, giggling. With the heavy load and high altitude, we're not setting any records, but now we're just charging up with all we have. Chris gets there first, while I just break out of the trees. He raises his arms and shouts, "The winner!" Egotist. I'm breathing so hard when I arrive I can't speak. We just drop our packs from our shoulders and lie down against some rocks. The crust of the ground is dry from the sun, but underneath is mud from last night's rain. Below us, and miles away beyond the forested slopes and the fields beyond them, is the Gallatin Valley. At one corner of the valley is Bozeman. A grasshopper jumps up from the rock and soars down and away from us over the trees.
"We made it," Chris says.
He is very happy. I am still too winded to answer. I take off my boots and socks, which are soggy with sweat, and set them out to dry in a rock. I stare at them meditatively as vapors from them rise up toward the sun. Chapter 20. Evidently I've slept. The sun is hot. My watch says a few minutes before noon. I look over the rock I'm leaning against and see Chris sound asleep on the other side. Way up above him, the forest stops, and barren gray rock leads into patches of snow. We can climb the back of this ridge straight up there, but it would be dangerous toward the top. I look up at the top of the mountain for a while. What was it Chris said I told him last night? I'll see you at the top of the mountain? No, I'll meet you at the top of the mountain. How could I meet him at the top of the mountain when I'm already with him? Something's very strange about that. He said I told him something else, too, the other night, that it's lonely here. That contradicts what I actually believe. I don't think it's lonely here at all. A sound of falling rock draws my attention over to one side of the mountain. Nothing moves, completely still. It's all right. You hear little rock slides like this all the time. Not so little sometimes, though. Avalanches start with little slides like that. If you're above them, or beside them, they're interesting to watch. But if they're above you, no help then. You just have to watch it come. People say strange things in their sleep, but why would I tell him I'll meet him? And why would he think I was awake? There's something really wrong here that produces a very bad quality feeling, but I don't know what it is. First you get the feeling, then you figure out why. I hear Chris move and turn and see him look around. "Where are we?" he asks. "Top of the ridge." "Oh," he says. He smiles. I break open a lunch of Swiss cheese, pepperoni, and crackers. I cut up the cheese and then the pepperoni in careful, neat slices. The silence allows you to do each thing right.
"Let's build a cabin here," he says.
"Oh," I groan, "and climb up to it every day?"
"Sure," he teases. "That wasn't hard."
Yesterday is long ago in his memory. I pass some cheese and crackers over to him.
"What are you always thinking about?" he asks.
"Thousands of things," I answer.
"What?"
"Most of them wouldn't make any sense to you."
"Like what?"
"Like why I told you I'd meet you at the top of the mountain."
"Oh,"
he says and looks down. "You said I sounded drunk," I tell him.
"No, not drunk,"
he says, still looking down. The way he looks away from me makes me wonder all over again if he's telling the truth. "How then?" He doesn't answer.
"How then, Chris?" "Just different."
"How?"
"Well, I don't know."
He looks up at me, and there's a flicker of fear.
"Like you used to sound a long time ago,"
he says, and then looks down.
"When?" "When we lived here."
I keep my face composed so that he sees no change of expression in it, then carefully get up and go over and methodically turn the socks on the rock. They've dried long ago. As I return with them, I see his glance is still on me. Casually, I say, "I didn't know I sounded different." He doesn't reply to this. I put the socks on and slip the boots over them.
"I'm thirsty," Chris says.
"We shouldn't have too far to go down to find water," I say, standing up. I look at the snow for a while, then say, "You ready to go?" He nods, and we get the packs on. As we walk along the summit toward the beginning of a ravine, we hear another clattering sound of falling rock, much louder than the first one I heard just a while ago. I look up to see where it is. Still nothing.
"What was that?"
Chris asks. "Rock slide." We both stand still for a moment, listening. Chris asks,
Is there somebody up there?
No, I think it's just melting snow that's loosening stones. When it's really hot like this in the early part of the summer, you hear a lot of small rock slides. Sometimes big ones. It's part of the wearing down of the mountains.
I didn't know mountains wore out.
Not wore out, wore down. They get rounded and gentle. These mountains are still unworn. Everywhere around us now, except above, the sides of the mountain are covered with blackish green of the forest. In the distance, the forest looks like velvet. I say, You look at these mountains now, and they look so permanent and peaceful, but they're changing all the time, and the changes aren't always peaceful. Underneath us, beneath us, here, right now, there are forces that can tear this whole mountain apart.
Do they ever?
Ever what?
Tear the whole mountain apart.
Yes, I say. Then I remember. Not far from here, there are 19 people lying dead under millions of tons of rock. Everyone was amazed there were only 19.
What happened?
They were just tourists from the east who had stopped for a night at a campground. During the night, the underground forces broke free, and when the rescuers saw what had happened the next morning, they just shook their heads. They didn't even try to excavate. All they could have done was dig down through hundreds of feet of rock for bodies that would just have to be buried all over again. So they left them there. They're still there now.
How did they know there were 19?
Neighbors and relatives from their hometowns reported them missing. Chris stares at the top of the mountain before us.
Didn't they get any warning?
I don't know.
You would think there'd be a warning.
Maybe there was. We walk to where the ridge we are on creases inward to the start of a ravine. I see that we can follow this ravine down and eventually find water in it. I start angling down now. Some more rocks clatter above us. Suddenly I'm frightened. Chris, I say.
What?
You know what I think?
No, what?
I think we'd be very smart if we let that mountaintop go for now and tried another summer. He's silent, then he says,
Why?
I have bad feelings about it. He doesn't say anything for a long time. Finally he says,
Like what?
Oh, I just think that we could get caught up there in a storm or a slide or something, and we'd be in real trouble. More silence. I look up and see real disappointment in his face. I think he knows I'm leaving something out. Why don't you think about it, I say, and then, when we get to some water and have lunch, we'll decide. We continue walking down. Okay, I say. He finally says, Okay, in a noncommittal voice. The descent is easy now, but I see it will be steeper soon. It's still open and sunny here, but soon we'll be in trees again. I don't know what to make of all this weird talk at night, except that it's not good. For either of us. It sounds like all the strain of this cycling and camping and Chautauqua and all these old places is a bad effect on me that appears at night. I want to clear out of here as fast as possible. I don't suppose that sounds like the old days to Chris, either. I spook very easily these days, and am not ashamed to admit it. He never spooked at anything. Never. That's the difference between us. That's why I'm alive and he's not. If he's up there, some psychic entity, some ghost, some doppelganger, waiting up there for us in God knows what fashion, well, he's going to have to wait a long time. A very long time. These damned heights get eerie after a while. I want to go down, way down, far, far down, to the ocean. That sounds right. Where the waves roll in slowly, and there's always a roar, and you can't fall anywhere. You're already there. Now we enter the trees again, and the side of the mountaintop is obscured by their branches, and I'm glad. I think we've gone as far along Phaedrus's path as we want to go in this Chautauqua, too. I want to leave his path now. I've given him all due credit for what he thought and said and wrote, and now I want to develop on my own some of the ideas he neglected to pursue. The title of this Chautauqua is Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, not Zen and the Art of Mountain Climbing. And there are no motorcycles on the tops of mountains, and in my opinion, very little Zen. Zen is the spirit of the valley, not the mountaintop. The only Zen you find on the tops of mountains is the Zen you bring up there. Let's get out of here. Feels good to be going down, doesn't it? I say. No answer. We're going to have a little fight, I'm afraid. You go up the mountaintop, and all you're going to get is a great big heavy stone tablet handed to you with a bunch of rules on it. That's about what happened to him. Thought he was a goddamn messiah. Not me, boy. The hours are way too long, and the pay is way too short. Let's go, let's go. Soon I'm clomping down the slope in a kind of two-step idiot gallop. Ga-dump, ga-dump, ga-dump. Until I hear Chris holler, "Slow down!" And he is a couple of hundred yards back through the trees. So I slow down, but after a while, see he is deliberately lagging behind. He's disappointed, of course. I suppose what I ought to do in the Chautauqua is just point out in summary form the direction Phaedrus went, without evaluation, and then get on with my own thing. Believe me, when the world is not seen as a duality of mind and matter, but as a trinity of quality mind and matter, then the art of motorcycle maintenance and other arts take on a dimension of meaning they never had. The specter of technology the Sutherlands are running from becomes not an evil, but a positive, fun thing. And to demonstrate that will be a long, fun task. But first, to give this other specter his walking papers, I should say the following. Perhaps he would have gone in the direction I am now about to go in, if this second wave of crystallization, the metaphysical wave, had finally grounded out where I'll be grounding it out, that is, in the everyday world. I think metaphysics is good if it improves everyday life. Otherwise, forget it. But unfortunately for him, it didn't ground out. It went into a third mystical wave of crystallization, from which he never recovered. He'd been speculating about the relationship of quality to mind and matter, and had identified quality as the parent of mind and matter, that event which gives birth to mind and matter. This Copernican inversion of the relationship of quality to the objective world could sound mysterious if not carefully explained, but he didn't mean it to be mysterious. He simply meant that at the cutting edge of time, before an object can be distinguished, there must be a kind of non-intellectual awareness, which he called awareness of quality. You can't be aware that you've seen a tree until after you've seen the tree, and between the instant of vision and instant of awareness, there must be a time lag. We sometimes think of that time lag as unimportant. But there's no justification for thinking that the time lag is unimportant. None whatsoever. The past exists only in our memories, the future only in our plans. The present is our only reality. The tree that you are aware of intellectually, because of that small time lag, is always in the past, and therefore is always unreal. Any intellectually conceived object is always in the past, and therefore unreal. Reality is always the moment of vision before the intellectualization takes place. There is no other reality. This pre-intellectual reality is what Phaedrus felt he had properly identified as quality. Since all intellectually identifiable things must emerge from this pre-intellectual reality, quality is the parent, the source of all subjects and objects. He felt that intellectuals usually have the greatest trouble seeing this quality, precisely because they are so swift and absolute about snapping everything into intellectual form. The ones who have the easiest time seeing this quality are small children, uneducated people, and culturally deprived people. These have the least predisposition toward intellectuality from cultural sources, and have the least formal training to instill it further into them. That, he felt, is why squareness is such a uniquely intellectual disease. He felt he'd been accidentally immunized from it, or at least to some extent broken from the habit, by his failure from school. After that, he felt no compulsive identification with intellectuality, and could examine anti-intellectual doctrines with sympathy. Squares, he said, because of their prejudices toward intellectuality, usually regard quality, the pre-intellectual reality, as unimportant, a mere uneventful transition period between objective reality and subjective perception of it. Because they have preconceived ideas of its unimportance, they don't seek to find out if it's in any way different from their intellectual conception of it. It is different, he said. Once you begin to hear the sound of that quality, see that Korean wall, that non-intellectual reality in its pure form, you want to forget all that word stuff, which you finally begin to see is always somewhere else. Now, armed with his new time-interrelated metaphysical trinity, he had that romantic classic quality split, the one which had threatened to ruin him, completely stopped. They couldn't cut up quality now. He could sit there, and at his leisure, cut them up. Romantic quality always correlated with instantaneous impressions. Square quality always involved multiple considerations that extended over a period of time. Romantic quality was the present, the here and now of things. Classic quality was always concerned with more than just the present. The relation of the present to the past and future was always considered. If you conceived the past and future to be all contained in the present, well, that was groovy. The present was what you lived for. And if your motorcycle is working, why worry about it? But if you consider the present to be merely an instant between the past and the future, just a passing moment, then to neglect the past and future for the present is bad quality indeed. The motorcycle may be working now, but when was the oil level last checked? Fuss budgetary from the romantic view, but good common sense from the classic. Now we had two different kinds of quality, but they no longer split quality itself. They were just two different time aspects of quality, short and long. What had previously been asked for was a metaphysical hierarchy that looked like this. Reality as a sum of subjective, mental, and objective, physical. Subjective is the sum of classic, intellectual, quality Phaedrus should be teaching, and romantic, emotional, quality Phaedrus was teaching. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Pirsig continued. Cassette 7, Side 1. What had previously been asked for was a metaphysical hierarchy that looked like this. Reality, as a sum of subjective, mental, and objective, physical. Subjective, as a sum of classical, intellectual, quality Phaedrus should be teaching, and romantic, emotional, quality Phaedrus was teaching. What he gave them in return was a metaphysical hierarchy that looked like this. Quality, reality, as a sum of romantic quality, pre-intellectual reality, and classical quality, intellectual reality. Classical quality, as a sum of subjective reality, mind, and objective reality, matter. The quality he was teaching was not just a part of reality, it was the whole thing. He then proceeded in terms of the Trinity to answer the question, why does everybody see quality differently? This was the question he had always had to answer, speciously before. Now he said, quality is shapeless, formless, indescribable. To see shapes and forms is to intellectualize. Quality is independent of any such shapes and forms. The names, the shapes, and forms we give quality depend only partly on the quality. They also depend partly on the a priori images we have accumulated in our memory. We constantly seek to find, in the quality event, analogs to our previous experiences. If we didn't, we'd be unable to act. We build up our language in terms of these analogs. We build up our whole culture in terms of these analogs. The reason people see quality differently, he said, is because they come to it with different sets of analogs. He gave linguistic examples, showing that to us the Hindi letters da, 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 and da, dha, all sound identical to us because we don't have analogues to them to sensitize us to their differences. Similarly, most Hindi-speaking people cannot distinguish between da, da, and the, the, because they are not so sensitized. It is not uncommon, he said, for Indian villagers to see ghosts, but they have a terrible time seeing the law of gravity. This, he said, explains why a class full of freshman composition students arrives at similar ratings of quality in the compositions. They all have relatively similar backgrounds and similar knowledge. But if a group of foreign students were brought in, or, say, medieval poems out of the range of class experience were brought in, then the students' ability to rank quality would probably not correlate as well. In a sense, he said, it's the student's choice of quality that defines him. People differ about quality not because quality is different, but because people are different in terms of experience. He speculated that if two people had identical a priori analogs, they would see quality identically every time. There was no way to test this, however, so it had to remain just speculation. In answer to his colleagues at school, he wrote, "Any philosophic explanation of quality is going to be both false and true precisely because it is a philosophic explanation. The process of philosophic explanation is an analytic process, a process of breaking something down into subjects and predicates. What I mean, and everybody else means, by the word quality, cannot be broken down into subjects and predicates. This is not because quality is so mysterious, but because quality is so simple, immediate, and direct. The easiest intellectual analog of pure quality that people in our environment can understand is that quality is the response of an organism to its environment." He used this example because his chief questioners seemed to see things in terms of stimulus-response behavior theory. An amoeba placed on a plate of water with a drip of dilute sulfuric acid placed nearby will pull away from the acid, I think. If it could speak, the amoeba, without knowing anything about sulfuric acid, could say, "This environment has poor quality." If it had a nervous system, it would act in a much more complex way to overcome the poor quality of the environment. It would seek analogs, that is, images and symbols from its previous experience to define the unpleasant nature of its new environment and thus understand it. In our highly complex organic state, we advanced organisms respond to our environment with an invention of many marvelous analogs. We invent earth and heavens, trees, stones and oceans, gods, music, arts, language, philosophy, engineering, civilization, and science. We call all these analogs reality, and they are reality. We mesmerize our children in the name of truth into knowing that they are reality. We throw anyone who does not accept these analogs into an insane asylum. But that which causes us to invent the analogs is quality. Quality is the continuing stimulus which our environment puts upon us to create the world in which we live. All of it. Every last bit of it. Now, to take that which has caused us to create the world and include it within the world we have created is clearly impossible. That is why quality cannot be defined. If we do define it, we are defining something less than quality itself. I remember this fragment more vividly than any of the others, possibly because it is the most important of all. When he wrote it, he felt momentary fright and was about to strike out the words, "all of it, every last bit of it." Madness there. I think he saw it. But he couldn't see any logical reason to strike these words out, and it was too late now for faint-heartedness. He ignored his warning and let the words stand. He put his pencil down and then felt something let go, as though something internal had been strained too hard and had given way. Then it was too late. He began to see that he had shifted away from his original stand. He was no longer talking about a metaphysical trinity, but an absolute monism. Quality was the source and substance of everything. A whole new flood of philosophic associations came to mind. Hegel had talked like this with his absolute mind. Absolute mind was independent, too, both of objectivity and subjectivity. However, Hegel said the absolute mind was the source of everything, but then excluded romantic experience from the everything it was the source of. Hegel's absolute was completely classical, completely rational, and completely orderly. Quality was not like that. Phaedrus remembered Hegel had been regarded as a bridge between Western and Oriental philosophy. The Vedanta of the Hindus, the Way of the Taoists, even the Buddha had been described as an absolute monism similar to Hegel's philosophy. Phaedrus doubted at the time, however, whether mystical ones and metaphysical monisms were introconvertible, since mystical ones follow no rules and metaphysical monisms do. Quality was a metaphysical entity, not a mystic one. Or was it? What was the difference? He answered himself that the difference was one of definition. Metaphysical entities are defined. Mystical ones are not. That made quality mystical. No, it was really both. Although he thought of it purely in philosophical terms up to now as metaphysical, he had all along refused to define it. That made it mystic, too. Its indefinability freed it from the rules of metaphysics. Then, on impulse, Phaedrus went over to his bookshelf and picked out a small blue cardboard-bound book. He'd hand-copied this book and bound it himself years before when he couldn't find a copy for sale anywhere. It was the 2,400-year-old Tao Te Ching of Lao Tzu. He began to read through the lines he had read many times before, but this time he studied it to see if a certain substitution would work. He began to read and interpret it at the same time. He read, "The quality that can be defined is not the absolute quality." That was what he had said. "The names that can be given it are not absolute names. It is the origin of heaven and earth. When named, it is the mother of all things." Exactly. Quality, romantic quality, and its manifestations, classic quality, are in their nature the same. It is given different names, subjects and objects, when it becomes classically manifest. Romantic quality and classic quality together may be called the mystic. Reaching from mystery into deeper mystery, it is the gate to the secret of all life. Quality is all-pervading, and its use is inexhaustible, fathomless, like the fountainhead of all things. Yet crystal clear like water it seems to remain. I do not know whose son it is, an image of what existed before God. Continuously, continuously, it seems to remain. Draw upon it, and it serves you with ease. Looked at, but cannot be seen, listened to, but cannot be heard, grasped at, but cannot be touched. These three elude all our inquiries, and hence blend and become one. Not by its rising is there light, not by its sinking is there darkness. Unceasing, continuous, it cannot be defined, and reverts again into the realm of nothingness. That is why it is called the form of the formless, the image of nothingness. That is why it is called elusive. Meet it, and you do not see its face. Follow it, and you do not see its back. He who holds fast to the quality of old is able to know the primeval beginnings, which are the continuity of quality. Phaedrus read on through line after line, verse after verse of this, watched them match, fit, slip into place. Exactly. This was what he meant. This was what he'd been saying all along, only poorly, mechanistically. There was nothing vague or inexact about this book. It was as precise and definite as it could be. It was what he had been saying, only in a different language with different roots and origins. He was from another valley, seeing what was in this valley, not now as a story told by strangers, but as a part of the valley he was from. He was seeing it all. He had broken the code. He read on, line after line, page after page. not a discrepancy.
What he had been talking about all the time as quality was here the Tao, the great central generating force of all religions, Oriental and Occidental, past and present, all knowledge, everything. Then his mind's eye looked up and caught his own image and realized where he was and what he was seeing, and I don't know what really happened, but now the slippage that Phaedrus had felt earlier, the internal parting of his mind, suddenly gathered momentum, as do the rocks at the top of a mountain. Before he could stop it, the sudden accumulated mass of awareness began to grow and grow into an avalanche of thought and awareness, out of control. With each additional growth of the downward-tearing mass loosening hundreds of times its volume, and then that mass uprooting hundreds of times its volume more, and then hundreds of times that. On and on, wider and broader, until there was nothing left to stand. No more anything. It all gave way from under him. Chapter 21.
You're not very brave, are you? Chris says.
No, I answer, and pull the rind of a slice of salami between my teeth to remove the meat.
But you'd be astonished at how smart I am.
We're down quite a way from the summit now, and the mixed pines and leafy underbrush are much higher here and more closed in than they were at this altitude on the other side of the canyon. Evidently, more rain gets into this canyon. I gulp down a large quantity of water from a pot Chris has filled at the stream here, then look at him.
I can see by his expression that he's resigned himself to going down, and there's no need to lecture him or argue.
We finish the lunch off with a part of a bag of candy, wash it down with another pot of water, and lay back on the ground for a rest.
Mountain spring water has the best taste in the world.
After a while, Chris says, I can carry a heavier load now.
Are you sure?
Sure, I'm sure, he says, a little haughtily.
Gratefully, I transfer some of the heavier stuff to his pack, and we put the packs on, wriggling through the shoulder straps on the ground, and then standing up. I can feel the difference in weight.
He can be considerate when he's in the mood.
From here on, it looks like a slow descent. This slope has evidently been logged, and there's a lot of underbrush higher than our heads that makes it slow going. We'll have to work our way around it. What I want to do now in the Chautauqua is get away from intellectual abstractions of an extremely general nature and into some solid, practical, day-to-day information. And I'm not quite sure how to go about this.
One thing about pioneers that you don't hear mentioned is that they are invariably, by their nature, messmakers. They go forging ahead, seeing only their noble, distant goal, and never notice any of the crud and debris they leave behind them. Someone else gets to clean that up, and it's not a very glamorous or interesting job. You have to depress for a while before you can get down to doing it. Then, once you have depressed into a really low-key mood, it isn't so bad. To discover a metaphysical relationship of quality and the Buddha at some mountaintop of personal experience is very spectacular. And very unimportant. If that were all this Chautauqua was about, I should be dismissed. What's important is the relevance of such a discovery to all the valleys of this world and all the dull, dreary jobs and monotonous years that await all of us in them. Sylvia knew what she was talking about the first day when she noticed all those people coming the other way. What did she call it? A funeral procession? The task now is to get back down to that procession with a wider kind of understanding than exists there now. First of all, I should say that I don't know whether Phaedrus's claim that quality is the Tao is true. I don't know of any way of testing it for truth, since all he did was simply compare his understanding of one mystic entity with another. He certainly thought they were the same, but he may not have completely understood what quality was. Or more likely, he may not have understood the Tao. He certainly was no sage, and there's plenty of advice for sages in that book he would have done well to heed. I think, furthermore, that all his metaphysical mountain climbing did absolutely nothing to further either our understanding of what quality is, or of what the Tao is. Not a thing.
That sounds like an overwhelming rejection of what he thought and said, but it isn't. I think it's a statement he would have agreed with himself. Since any description of quality is a kind of definition and must therefore fall short of its mark. I think he might have even said that statements of the kind he had made, which fall short of their mark, are even worse than no statement at all, since they can be easily mistaken for truth and thus retard an understanding of quality. No, he did nothing for quality or the Tao. What benefited was reason. He showed a way by which reason may be expanded to include elements that have previously been unassimilable and thus have been considered irrational. I think it's the overwhelming presence of these irrational elements, crying for assimilation, that creates the present bad quality, the chaotic, disconnected spirit of the 20th century. I want to go at these now, in as orderly a manner as possible. We're on a steep, mucky soil now, that's hard to keep a footing in. We grab branches and shrubs to steady ourselves. I take a step, then figure where my next step will be, then take this step, then look again. Soon the brush becomes so thick, I see we will have to hack through it. I sit down while Chris gets the machete from the pack on my back. He hands it to me, then, hacking and chopping, I head into the brush. It's slow going. Two or three branches must be cut for every step. It may go on like this for a long time. The first step down from Phaedrus's statement that quality is the Buddha is a statement that such an assertion, if true, provides a rational basis for a unification of three areas of human experience which are now disunified. These areas are religion, art, and science. If it can be shown that quality is the central term of all three, and that this quality is not of many kinds, but of one kind only, then it follows that the three disunified areas have a basis for introconversion. The relationship of quality to the area of art has been shown rather exhaustively through a pursuit of Phaedrus's understanding of quality in the art of rhetoric. I don't think much more in the way of analysis need be made there. Art is high-quality endeavor. That is all that really needs to be said. Or, if something more high-sounding is demanded, art is the Godhead as revealed in the works of man. The relationship established by Phaedrus makes it clear that the two enormously different-sounding statements are actually identical. In the area of religion, the rational relationship of quality to the Godhead needs to be more thoroughly established, and this I hope to do much later on. For the time being, one can meditate on the fact that the English roots for the Buddha and quality, God and good, appear to be identical. It's in the area of science that I want to focus attention in the immediate future, for this is the area that most badly needs the relationship established. The dictum that science and its offspring technology are value-free, that is, quality-free, has got to go. It's that value freedom that underlines the death force effect to which attention was brought early in the Chautauqua. Tomorrow I intend to start on that. For the remainder of the afternoon, we climb down over gray-weathered trunks of deadfalls and angle back and forth on the steep slope. We reach a cliff, angle along its edge in search of a way down, and eventually a narrow draw appears which we're able to descend. It continues down through a rocky crevice in which there is a little rivulet. Shrubs and rocks and muck and roots of huge trees, watered by the rivulet, fill the crevice. Then we hear the roar of a much larger creek in the distance. We cross the creek using a rope, which we leave behind. Then on the road beyond, find some other campers who give us a ride into town. In Bozeman, it's dark and late. Rather than wake up the Deweses and ask them to drive in, we check in at the main downtown hotel. Some tourists in the lobby stare at us. With my old army clothes, walking stick, two-day beard, and black beret, I must look like some old-time Cuban revolutionary, in for a raid. In the hotel room, we exhaustedly dump everything on the floor. I empty into a wastebasket the stones picked up by my boots from the rushing water of the stream, then set the boots by a cold window to dry slowly. We collapse into the beds without a word. Chapter 22. The next morning we check out of the hotel, feeling refreshed, say goodbye to the DeWeeses, and head north on the open road out of Bozeman. The DeWeeses wanted us to stay, but a peculiar itching to move west and get on with my